Chapter 16. Now then, let us look at this mighty question reasonably, rationally, sanely, yes, and calmly, not excitedly. What is the real function, the essential function, the supreme function, of language? Isn't it merely to convey ideas and emotions? Certainly. Then if we can do it with words of phonetic brevity and compactness, why keep the present cumbersome forms? But can we? Yes. I hold in my hand the proof of it. Here is a letter written by a woman, right out of her heart of hearts. I think she never saw a spelling book in her life. The spelling is her own. There isn't a waste letter in it anywhere. It reduces the phonetics to the last gasp. It squeezes the surplusage out of every word. There's no spelling that can begin with it on this planet outside of the White House. And as for the punctuation, there isn't any. It is all one sentence, eagerly and breathlessly uttered, without break or pause in it anywhere. The letter is absolutely genuine. I have the proofs of that in my possession. I can't stop to spell the words for you, but you can take the letter presently, and comfort your eyes with it. I will read the letter. Miss dear friend, I took some clothes into the armory, and give them to you to send to the sufferers out to California, and I hate to trouble you, but I got to have one of them back. It was a black all-wool cheviot with a jacket to mock trim kind of fancy, no 38 burst measure and palsy mentory across the front, and the color I wouldn't trouble you, but it belonged to my brother's wife, and she is mad about it. I thought she was willin', but she says she want, done with it, and she was going to wear it a spell longer. She ain't so free-hearted as what I am, and she has got more to do with than I have, having a husband to work and slave. For her I gels you remember me, I am shot and stout and light-complected. I talked with you quite a spell about the sufferers, and said it was awful about that earthquake. I shouldn't wonder if they had another one right off. Seeing general condition of the country is kind of explosive. I hate to take that black dress away from the sufferers, but I will hunt round and see if I can get another one. If I can, I will call to the armory for it. If you will just lay it aside so no more at present from your true friend, I like your appearance very much. Now you see what simplified spelling can do. It can convey any fact you need to convey, and it can pour out emotions like a sower. I beg you, I beseech you, to adopt our spelling, and print all your dispatches in it. Now I wish to say just one entirely serious word. I have reached a time of life, 70 years and a half, where none of the concerns of this world have much interest for me personally. I think I can speak dispassionately upon this matter, because in the little while that I have got to remain here I can get along very well with these old-fashioned forms, and I don't propose to make any trouble about it at all. I shall soon be where they won't care how I spell so long as I keep the Sabbath. There are 82 millions of us people that use this orthography, and it ought to be simplified in our behalf, but it is kept in its present condition to satisfy 1 million people who like to have their literature in the old form. That looks to me to be rather selfish, and we keep the forms as they are while we have got 1 million people coming in here from foreign countries every year, and they have got to struggle with this orthography of ours, and it keeps them back and damages their citizenship for years until they learn to spell the language, if they ever do learn. This is merely sentimental argument. People say it is the spelling of Chaucer and Spencer and Shakespeare, and a lot of other people who do not know how to spell anyway, and it has been transmitted to us, and we preserved it and wish to preserve it, because of its ancient and hallowed associations. Now, I don't see that there is any real argument about that. If that argument is good, then it would be a good argument not to banish the flies and the cockroaches from hospitals, because they have been there so long that the patients have got used to them, and they feel a tenderness for them on account of the associations. Why, it is like preserving a cancer in a family, because it is a family cancer, and we are bound to it by the test of affection and reverence and old, moldy antiquity. I think that this declaration, To improve this orthography of ours is our family cancer, and I wish we could reconcile ourselves to have it cut out, and let the family cancer go. Now, you see before you the wreck and ruin of what was once a young person like yourselves. I am exhausted by the heat of the day. I must take what is left of this wreck, and run out of your presence, and carry it away to my home, and spread it out there and sleep the sleep of the righteous. There is nothing much left of me, but my age and my righteousness, but I leave with you my love and my blessing, and may you always keep your youth. Books and Burglars, addressed to the Reading, Con. Library Association, October 28, 1908. Suppose this library had been in operation a few weeks ago, and the burglars who happened along, and broke into my house, taking a lot of things they didn't need, and for that matter which I didn't need, had first made entry into this institution. Picture them seated here on the floor, poring by the light of their dark dash lanterns over some of the books they found, and thus absorbing moral truths, and getting a moral uplift. The whole course of their lives would have been changed. As it was, they kept straight on in their immoral way, and were sent to jail. For all we know, they may next be sent to Congress. And, speaking of burglars, let us not speak of them too harshly. Now, I have known so many burglars, not exactly known, but so many of them have come near me in my various dwelling places, that I am disposed to allow them credit for whatever good qualities they possess. Chief among these, and, indeed, the only one I just now think of, is their great care while doing business, to avoid disturbing people's sleep. Noiseless as they may be while at work, however, the effect of their visitation is to murder sleep later on. Now we are prepared for these visitors. All sorts of alarm devices have been put in the house, and the ground for half a mile around it has been electrified. The burglar who steps within this danger zone will set loose a bedlam of sounds, and spring into readiness for action our elaborate system of defenses. As for the fate of the trespasser, do not seek to know that. He will never be heard of more. Authors Club, address at the dinner given in honor of Mr. Clemens, London, June, 1899. Mr. Clemens was introduced by Sir Walter Bezaa. It does not embarrass me to hear my books praised so much. It only pleases and delights me. I have not gone beyond the age when embarrassment is possible, but I have reached the age when I know how to conceal it. It is such a satisfaction to me to hear Sir Walter Bezaa, who is much more capable than I to judge of my work, deliver a judgment which is such a contentment to my spirit. Well, I have thought well of the books myself, but I think more of them now. It charms me also to hear Sir Spencer Walpole deliver a similar judgment, and I shall treasure his remarks also. I shall not discount the praises in any possible way. When I report them to my family, they shall lose nothing. There are, however, certain heredities which come down to us which our writings of the present day may be traced to. I, for instance, read the Walpole letters when I was a boy. I absorbed them, gathered in their grace, wit, and humor, and put them away, to be used by and by. One does that so unconsciously with things one really likes. I am reminded now of what use those letters have been to me. They must not claim credit in America for what was really written in another form so long ago. They must only claim that I trimmed this, that, and the other, and so changed their appearance, as to make them seem to be original. You now see what modesty I have in stock. But it has taken long practice to get it there. But I must not stand here talking. I merely meant to get up and give my thanks for the pleasant things that preceding speakers have said of me. I wish also to extend my thanks to the Authors Club for constituting me a member at a reasonable price per year, and for giving me the benefit of your legal adviser. I believe you keep a lawyer. I have always kept a lawyer too, though I have never made anything out of him. It is service to an author to have a lawyer. There is something so disagreeable in having a personal contact with a publisher. So it is better to work through a lawyer and lose your case. I understand that the publishers have been meeting together also like us. I don't know what for, but possibly they are devising new and mysterious ways for remunerating authors. I only wish now to thank you for electing me a member of this club. I believe I have paid my dues, and to thank you again for the pleasant things you have said of me. Last February, when Rudyard Kipling was ill in America, the sympathy which was poured out to him was genuine and sincere, and I believe that which cost Kipling so much will bring England and America closer together. I have been proud and pleased to see this growing affection and respect between the two countries. I hope it will continue to grow, and, please God, it will continue to grow. I trust we authors will leave to posterity, if we have nothing else to leave, a friendship between England and America that will count for much. I will now confess that I have been engaged for the past 8 days in compiling a publication. I have brought it here to lay at your feet. I do not ask your indulgence in presenting it, but for your applause. Here it is. Since England and America may be joined together in Kipling, may they not be severed in twain. Apostrophe. Booksellers, address at banquet on Wednesday evening, May 20, 1908, of the American Booksellers Association, which included most of the leading booksellers of America, held at the rooms of the Yalden Association, New York. This annual gathering of booksellers from all over America comes together ostensibly to eat and drink, but really to discuss business. Therefore, I am required to talk shop. I am required to furnish a statement of the indebtedness under which I lie to you gentlemen for your help in enabling me to earn my living. For something over 40 years I have acquired my bread by print, beginning with The Innocents Abroad, followed at intervals of a year or so by Roughing It, Tom Sawyer, Gilded Age, and so on. For 36 years my books were sold by subscription. You are not interested in those years, but only in the four which have since followed. The books passed into the hands of my present publishers at the beginning of 1900, and you then became the providers of my diet. I think I may say, without flattering you, that you have done exceedingly well by me. Exceedingly well is not too strong a phrase, since the official statistics show that in 4 years you have sold twice as many volumes of my venerable books as my contract with my publishers bound you and them to sell in 5 years. To your sorrow, you are aware that frequently, much too frequently, when a book gets to be 5 or 10 years old, its annual sale shrinks to 200 or 300 copies, and after an added 10 or 20 years ceases to sell. But you sell thousands of my moss-backed old books every year, the youngest of them being books that range from 15 to 27 years old, and the oldest reaching back to 35 and 40. By the terms of my contract, my publishers had to account to me for 50,000 volumes per year for 5 years, and pay me for them, whether they sold them or not. It is at this point that you gentlemen come in, for it was your business to unload 250,000 volumes upon the public in 5 years, if you possibly could. Have you succeeded? Yes, you have, and more. For in 4 years, with a year still to spare, you have sold the 250,000 volumes, and 240,000 besides. Your sales have increased each year. In the first year you sold 90,328, in the second year, 104,851, in the third, 133,975. In the fourth year, which was last year, you sold 160,000. The aggregate for the 4 years is 500,000 volumes, lacking 11,000. Of the oldest book, The Innocents Abroad, now 40 years old, you sold upward of 46,000 copies in the 4 years. Of Roughing It, now 30-8 years old, I think you sold 40,334. Of Tom Sawyer, 41,000. And so on. And there is one thing that is peculiarly gratifying to me. The personal recollections of Joan of Arc is a serious book. I wrote it for love, and never expected it to sell, but you have pleasantly disappointed me in that matter. In your hands its sale was increased each year. In 1904 you sold 1726 copies. In 1905, 2445. In 1906, 5381. And last year, 6574. Mark Twain's first appearance, on October 5, 1906, Mr. Clemens, following a musical recital by his daughter in Norfolk, Connecticut, addressed her audience on the subject of stage fright. He thanked the people for making things as easy as possible for his daughter's American debut as a contralto, and then told of his first experience before the public. My heart goes out in sympathy to anyone who is making his first appearance before an audience of human beings. By a direct process of memory I go back 40 years, less 1 month, for I'm older than I look. I recall the occasion of my first appearance. San Francisco knew me then only as a reporter, and I was to make my bow to San Francisco as a lecturer. I knew that nothing short of compulsion would get me to the theater. So I bound myself by a hard and fast contract, so that I could not escape. I got to the theater 45 minutes before the hour set for the lecture. My knees were shaking, so that I didn't know whether I could stand up. If there is an awful, horrible malady in the world, it is stage fright and seasickness. They are a pair. I had stage fright then for the first and last time. I was only seasick once too. It was on a little ship on which there were 200 other passengers. I was sick. I was so sick that there wasn't any left for those other 200 passengers. It was dark and lonely behind the scenes in that theater, and I peeked through the little peekholes they have in theater curtains, and looked into the big auditorium. That was dark and empty too. By and by it lighted up, and the audience began to arrive. I had got a number of friends of mine, stalwart men, to sprinkle themselves through the audience armed with big clubs. Every time I said anything they could possibly guess I intended to be funny, they were to pound those clubs on the floor. Then there was a kind lady in a box up there, also a good friend of mine, the wife of the governor. She was to watch me intently, and whenever I glanced toward her, she was going to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.